You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahiahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa.
Ko sofia toku ingoa, nau mai haru mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Today is a very special show, it's Maya's birthday. Happy birthday, Maya!
Thanks!
I've totally embarrassed her and made her birthday crown and brought her cake, and gonna eat that and do all that very, very shortly.
Oh, yes, I walked into the studio and so had her colouring pencils out and was making me a crown, which I've been prancing around in my birthday dress all morning. Thank you, Miss Sof. So sweet.
You're welcome. You're welcome. We do, of course, have the usual rundown of things, which we'll give you a little rundown on that now. Maya, what have you got today?
I caught up with artist Mitchell McGrath about his current exhibition on at Window Gallery, A View for Each Eye.
And I had a kōrero with artists Nephi Tupaya and Ani O'Neill about their current exhibition together at Tim Melville Gallery, Ngā Tai Whatu, Woven Dreams.
He aha ofakara, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsahi mai, you can text us on 5395 5395 or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koe e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakiheri rokiroki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Before we get into things, though, we're going to have some cake. Yeah. Okay.
Yay!
Talk soon. Bye.
And What's it all for?
Various artists.
Mitchell McGrath is a Tamaki-based designer and artist whose work explores notions of spatial perception through these embodied material exploration of imaging techniques that is transferred into works of embodied materiality in spaces, experiences, and objects. In his current exhibition at Window Gallery, A View for Each Eye, McGrath presents these beautiful luminescent installations of colour and its shifting movements through space, an exploration of these fluxing wavelengths of chromatic colours in relation to our own bodily position. The colours and form shift and pivot as one moves throughout the space, a dance of colour that rewards a lengthened viewing, a viewing individual to each eye, person and body, as one delves into the exhibition's shifting chromatic landscape. I had a chat with Mitchell about the show and overall practice.
Kia ora, I'm Mitchell, and my practice is more of a design, expanded design practice. So at the moment, the exhibition at Window Gallery, I was doing material tests and coming across this really sort of mesmerizing window film, dichronic window film that's generally used, applied on glass, architectural glass, and depending on your position to it, it shows different colors. So I was working with it probably 5 years ago, and at that point it was quite cost prohibitive. So I was working with little samples and sort of embedding them onto objects and then diffusing that, and was interested in how we experience it as we move around it. So that was really quite a turning point for me. I just came back to that work several years down the line and thought, oh, that was really interesting, but now how would I do it differently if it was to do it today? And I made a small kind of maquette, like a little box, diffused it with acrylic, and let it hang in the box, sort of free floats. And it was really, for me, it was really quite strong. And I thought, okay, well, what would happen if it went up in scale and became more of a like architectural scale?
Mm.
So that was really how it started.
Yeah, you've already kind of mentioned it, but you've got your current exhibition at Window Gallery titled A View for Each Eye. And yeah, it showcases this beautiful luminescent display of colour and its shifting movements through space. You've already kind of like gotten into it a little bit, but I want to backtrack a tad and kind of start off by speaking to the footing of this project and where it kind of arose from, what kind of, yeah, brought you to work with these materials and like work with this concept?
I think a turning point for me, I saw work by Brazilian artist Alio Atishia, and there was these what I would describe as sort of exploded paintings, but there were also paintings and sculptural and installation, but they introduced sort of participation, so you walk around them and the colours change and the form changes, the colour recedes, and that had quite an effect on me. And so, yeah, I was trying to bring in participation, so you have a different experience every sort of viewpoint from the work, and it's constantly shifting. It's static, obviously, but it is always moving. It's never the same image that you see.
Yeah, beautiful. And the way that you use colour within your work, it's almost like colour is this, yeah, you utilise it as if colour is a material itself, as if a painter would use it, but you utilise it with its own embodied lens. Do you want to speak a little bit to the role and importance of colour within this work and perhaps why you are drawn to it as kind of like a prominent material?
Mm. And a really important text that I read was Surface by Giuliana Bruno, who argues that we see surface and colour of surface as quite shallow, but it actually has more depth to it. It can invoke memory and thought and place. So it's creating more of a depth out of surface. And I'm attracted to the colour. I'm also interested, David Batchelor, artist and theorist, has a really interesting book called Chromophobia, and he argues that colour is seen as this otherness. It's in Western thought and Western critique, it's kind of denigrated as a lesser than art practice, as opposed to form and line that we sort of generate colour, we happens naturally and we just rearrange it. So he argues that it does have importance.
Yes, with colour, I've also noticed within that, that history of female artists, there's that, correlation with colour, and it's also that it's not as important, and it's like this topic that's like, oh, colour and da-da-da-da.
Yeah, it's superficial, right? Yeah. It's seen as quite shallow, and it's seen as feminine, cosmetic.
More like domestic. In a sense, yeah.
David Batchelor also argues that it's quite queer, it's quite primitive, and even more problematic, it's quite oriental. He sort of argues that Eastern practices have traditionally been brilliant colourists. How do we distinguish Western practice from that? You know, its line and form has more importance.
Yeah, but I like, yes, line and form, but for me, colour is such a... It's not just...
It's everything, right?
It's everything. Yeah. Like, it's not like, oh, this is blue because it's blue and that's that. It's like each colour has such a feeling and a history. If you look back into, like, the pigments and the...
Yeah.
Like, such a rich history and such relation to feeling and mood. And it's like, I don't know why we disregard it.
Yeah,
so I think it's so beautiful that you're putting colour at the forefront of this and really bringing it into that embodied space. In your exhibition text, you reference this bodily position to colour, the shifting of wavelengths of colour in relation to our bodily position. Do you want to speak a bit more to this, that element of colour in relation to our bodies?
For me, that essentially is the participation we have with it. So we're moving around it, kind of, it, in a sense, it's what you bring to it as well. So I guess the title For Each Eye also delves into everyone has a different way of perceiving it, perceiving colour, perceiving the forms. So it's moving around and hopefully moving through you, depending on, I don't know, you might spend 20 seconds or 2 minutes with it, but it does reward, I hope, at least rewards looking. It rewards these little moments that I've put in there. For example, I just chose to wrap the existing fluorescent lights that were there. And so when you approach them, they softly change as you get closer. There's little elements like that I wanted to, again, reward people for participating.
Yeah, I always think that within exhibition, the relation to the body is such a big component to it, and shifts each viewing experience because everyone comes at it with their own, I don't know if this is weird to say, but like in their own body and their own things, and it's like also with yours having such a heightened quality of that bodily interaction as you shift in mood, and it really, not forces people, but invites people to engage with it at a different level and to, maybe shift their perspective on colour and how one might view a work.
Definitely.
In a gallery space. I also wanted to speak a bit about, in your text you also wrote about this, that memory of your father's black and white television, and now the shift to this chromatic colour usage that we surround ourselves with. Do you want to speak a little bit about that, transition of colour through time and how it kind of has that quite like generational shift with it?
Definitely. And that was in the room shape. What I was trying to evoke was what it brings up for me. So when I found out the material was developed by NASA to sort of block UV light, I then had that memory or that just sort of popped in my head. I mean, my dad always explaining the moon landing, and I just remembered it in black and white when he was explaining it, because he was explaining it in the black and white image. And so that was really just, I just went there. So there's this nice sort of intergenerational experience. But there's also, again, David Batchelor, he mentions how colour is sometimes also used in like a fall into colour, and he references The Wizard of Oz. Mm. And so Dorothy is in the farm, black and white, and then falls into Oz, brilliant colour, and then returns back to black and white. So that was kind of what I was trying to get at, is just these different ways of seeing colour.
Yeah, beautiful. And do you want to speak a little bit to this material that you said NASA produced?
Crazy, right?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. Like, what could you tell me a bit about?
I know. I mean, I'm no scientist myself, but it is such like a Charmeleon type material. Obviously, draconic glass has been around since ancient time, but they've developed in the space race a way of applying it on polycarbonate as sort of helmets or to block UV light again. But it's essentially just like thin, very thin metals that get vaporized in a vacuum chamber and then applied to the surface. So it's quite high tech.
Yeah.
But once I discovered it, I saw it and I recognised it, I sort of see it out in the wild quite a lot. It's used in a lot of sort of architectural applications on facades, but also in like retail displays, in really commercial experiences. So I'm kind of interested in about that as well, taking the commercial material and then sort of elevating it, I guess.
Yeah, placing it in that art context what that shift kind of does for that material itself.
Mm.
So there's no, I'm very unfamiliar with this material. So there's no, when you're going through that making process, you don't have control over the colour?
Correct,
okay.
There's this nice dance because you try to control the material and then eventually it kind of just controls you, and it's, you kind of have to let that happen. I remember at one point as I was doing iterations, so I made the work in my garage turn studio, and then I made a little sort of scale replica as best as I could of the gallery with the spacing and a large sheet of perspex as the glass to try and investigate really how I could play with this material. How would it look draped? Also, how do I diffuse it? What's the best material to diffuse it? So no, I don't control the direct colours that come out of it, but I hope to control in the show. There's two wires that run across to hang it and to give it this sort of shower curtain type direction. And then it sort of folds in on itself and it projects colour in and out, all around. It's,
wow.
That's kind of the only control I have on
it. Okay, wow, crazy. Because looking at it, if anyone goes to see it, which hopefully they do, because it's a window gallery is like this big glass container, and you really can't really tell what's behind that glass.
It takes a moment, I hope.
Yeah, even with my moment, I was still a bit like, it's got this real, I don't know, maybe you're not, but that mysterious quality, perhaps linking to that kind of like moon landing, that thing, that mysterious quality of like, I can't quite wrap my head around it. And that's this thing that you maybe, as a viewer, you can't quite reach, you can't quite touch.
Mm. It's sort of,
yeah,
it's only that front view, you can't go around, right?
No,
and the diffusion, I think, for me is kind of, it invokes memory. It's like a non-linear time image narrative, you could say, of working with time, with memory, and then again going back to that intergenerational memory invoking quality.
And was the gallery space of window, you must have had like quite a big consideration with that, because it's quite a unique gallery space. Did you really hone into that viewing experience of that glass wall? Because is it quite different to how you've maybe used that material in the past?
Yeah, well, typically the material is just sort of applied to glass, the substrate, and it's flat. So I was more interested in, it's just so interesting off the roll, when you see the material rolled up, it's just quite magical. So how do I do that in space, basically? How does it float in space? There was quite a lot of consideration about the distance to the front diffused panel of glass, too far back and it sort of disappears, too close and it becomes too obvious. So it was that sweet spot of finding it. It was quite a risk. I remember, because I was making it, generally would come home from my day job and then making it at night after the sun had gone down. And for a long time, I then realised, oh, this is going to be a day experience.
Yeah.
So I was quite a little bit anxious about whether or not it would actually work. And thankfully, it is different during the day, but I think it does, again, it has a different experience if you see it during the day or you see it through the window at night. It's quite different.
Yeah, there's heaps of different viewing options. It's kind of in this transitional space, also being in that foyer of the Auckland Uni Library. So it's got all of those people kind of walking through it, different times of day, seeing it from outside. It's, really beautiful and really, I'm trying to think of that word. It's like in like a kind of like threshold space, which I think is really, really lovely. And lastly, what are your hopes for viewers as they experience and engage with your work?
It's kind of just a celebration of joy, I hope. It is kind of, hopefully you're rewarded again for participating by looking. The further you look, you might notice new things. The closer you get, you might notice a different perspective, and then further back it's different. So it's kind of just what they bring to it and what memories and feelings it evokes for them.
That was Mitchell McGrath speaking to me about his current exhibition on at Window Gallery, A View for Each Eye, which is on until the 7th of January 2026. So go check that out.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
And now, because it is my birthday, I am on playlist. We've got some Julia Jacklin, and I did see her perform with Fantastic Furniture last night, which was so wonderful to see Miss Julia again. Love her stuff. This is Pressure to Party. Enjoy.
Yes. at 95 BFM, we ran out of ideas for merch, so we got the kids to do it. And honestly, the future of graphic design is in excellent hands.
We have just dropped a 95 BFM kids show tee, and it's been designed by one very talented kids show listener. Thanks, mate. We've also got staple tees and hats available to purchase. So get your summer outfit sorted and pre-order your 95 BFM merch now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morning, Mr. Sloth, Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show, bringing stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago. The 95 BFM Kids Show with Finn, 7 to 9 every Sunday morning on BFM.
Future sounds from the underground.
Precisely.
The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world.
Totally wired.
Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future.
Next month, even.
Some of these tracks are like 2027 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95 BFM. Thanks to Flying Out. flyingout.co.nz.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
Ngā Tai Whatu, Woven Dreams is an exhibition by artists Arnie O'Neill and Nephi Tupaya currently on at Tim Melville Gallery. Both artists members of the Pacific Sisters Artist Collective, the exhibition shows new paintings by Nephi Tupaya and a suite of Arnie O'Neill's crochet paintings in response. In placing O'Neill and Tupaya's practices in conversation with each other, intertwined and weaved together, the space embodies the whanaunatanga that fundamentally underlies the Pacific Sisters kaupapa. I had a kōrero with Ani and Nephi about the show, the Pacific Sisters, and their overall practices.
Kia ora, nā tātou katoa. Thank you, Sophia, for having us. My name is Ani O'Neill. I'm an artist of Cook Island Māori and Irish descent. My family lines come from the Ngāti Makea tribe in Rarotonga and Ngāti Titika on Titikawaka. And my dad's family comes from County Cork. We've never been there, but would one day love to go to Ireland. I was brought up in Auckland and did fine arts at Auckland University at Elam. My practice is sculptural installation and then working with body, with Pacific Sisters. We hate to say fashion, but, you know, we definitely rocked it in the 90s. And that's where I met my beautiful friend Nephi.
Kia ora tātou, ko Nephi Tupaya tōku ingoa, no kahungunu no tainui ahau. I was brought up in Heretonga, Mangawharau, Havelock North. I'm the youngest of five siblings. Mum and Dad came down to the Hawke's Bay. My kōrero's from down here anyway, so Mum and Dad came down to Hawke's Bay for during the urban drift, where whānau were looking for jobs, you know, they leaving their pukainga. They, you know, it was very common back in those days. So here I am, 2018, tend to come and look after mum. So I've been here for like 8 years. I've been looking after my mum for 8 years and returned to the home that I was actually, where mum's waters, sacred waters had broken on the kitchen, fell to the kitchen floor. So I say to everybody that I was actually born in this house. So my art practice is I do a lot of really self-taught. I've always been a self-taught artist, so I've always made and created things, usually tactile textiles, creating like the word fashion, garments, body adornments. So, and I left here when I was 17, where back in the day, back in the early 80s and 90s, you did that to where you had no qualifications, no nothing. You just pursued your dreams and you just went for it. And were really fearless back then, had no idea what I was doing, but I did have my passion was to follow my arts. So, yeah, and I met Suzanne Tamaki and started making things together and joined together as Pacific Sisters. So it's sort of fruition into that. And then I met Ani and Rosanna and all these amazing artists and Lisa and Fiona and just got together and formed this beautiful, amazing sisterhood. So when I left Auckland, went overseas, came back to look after mum, I needed to pursue another career, which was exploring in painting and arts, and studied under the great Matua Sandy Adsett. But then he was taken over by Tracy Keith, who became my mentor, my tōrakana, and everything, and my support, as a painter.
You both spoke really beautifully there about the Pacific Sisters, of course, which has become one of the most influential art collectives in Aotearoa. I'd love to hear a little bit more, a bit of guess about like your involvement and how that has maybe kind of shaped your art practices as well. How is being a part of this collective impacted or influences your practices respectively?
Yeah, I met Pacific Sisters when I was just wrapping up my kind of third and fourth year at art school. We actually met, I was standing there with my friend Sulolo, who became Planet Tonga as a label. We were at university still. We bumped into Rosanna and Fiona going to a kind of a casting, and they invited us to come along and be models for the first Pacifica fashion show, which Rosanna was directing back in 93. So, yeah, it was kind of like, yeah, why not? I'd sort of done some theatre stuff while I was at uni with Pacific Theatre, and really loved doing collaborative, you know, theatrical kind of performance fashion show stuff. Been dabbling in it for a little bit, modelling and stuff, and so went along and got to meet the whole family. It really was like the, you know, there's Rosanna sort of talks about it like the Andy Warhol's factory. It was a little bit like that. And then the following year, I entered as a designer, and I actually won the show, which was hilarious. And Pacific Sisters came second from memory, and Suzanne was like, oh, if you're going to win, you might as well become a Pacific Sister. So they won the next year. And so, yeah, the following year I did set design. So, you know, it was just sort of this great outlet where you could, if you were sort of had the time and the energy and the kind of inclination, you got kind of chucked a job. And we were all super multi-talented. We'd share skills. And so a lot of the, you know, it was just sort of like full 360 shows that we were making, and we were all chipping in on set design, costume design, modelling, music, you know, you name it, A-Fly. And then it was kind of like, who's going to wear this? So quite often all the skimpy stuff went on to Fly. Yeah, but definitely the bravery, just being surrounded by people who you knew had your back and had your front and your upside downs, and yeah, just supporting each other through those times and making all these like really great events, and yeah, watching it all blossom in different places, and then kind of taking that into art spaces, which was really special with the I think the first major art space we kind of entered into together was with the Bottled Ocean exhibition when it came up to Auckland, which was in 94-95. So that's when it sort of turned into becoming an art thing as opposed to just a fashion thing. But we were always really looking at our stories, the stories that we sort of were really interested in learning about and how they connected across the Pacific and across different Moana people. So we worked with Lisa Ray Hunter as well with the Interdigitate at the Aotea Centre, which was like a, I think, 6x6 video, digital video wall experience, theatrical experience, and other artists were involved in that. And we presented a show called Ina and Tuna, told the story of how the coconut tree became sort of the story of how the coconut tree became, basically, through the love of a giant eel and a beautiful maiden, Sina Hina Ina. And from a great flood, Ina's job was to chop off the head of the tuna, the eel that came to her door, her lover, and basically buried it. And from that head grew the coconut tree. And so when you see a coconut and you see the three little dots, that's two eyes and a mouth, and you're drinking from a coconut, you're kissing the lips of tuna. So that's the story that we presented way back then. It's a creation story, and we sort of, we're just really using those opportunities to kind of expand our own kind of physical knowledge and living through some of those stories by kind of presenting them on platforms that we we're lucky to share.
I'm so glad you started, Ani, because you've got a better memory than I do. Because we've covered so much and over those years, it's like we've done so much. It's like when people ask me to break it, when I do talks and people ask me about how is Pacific Sisters, can you break it down in 10 minutes? I'm like, oh, hell no. So there's so much information and so much we've done. It's just been a journey of incredible talent and creativity and visionaries. So for me, the Pacific Sisters was all about manaakitanga and whanaungatanga. Like when I met Suzanne and when I met Favo Balipo at the time when she joined, when I was living with Favo and Selena Pami, it was like a community that I was really drawn to, because I was with my sister. My sister was living with me, Teresa Tupaya. I was, you know, a creative in a big city. We're country girls. We're from, you know, Little Hawke's Bay, Havelock North. We were from a village. So to be exposed to the city life, it was like, wow, you know, and to be exposed to all these other, because Hawke's Bay is quite Pākehā-fied, especially Havelock North is a very Pākehā-fied colonial village where I come from. So to come into a space where there's tangata, moana, tangata people was like, holy shit, this is incredible. And to actually meet these people, not only that they were amazing, but really, really creative. So I found my people, I found my community, and to have Suzanne and to meet Ani and to meet Rosanna. And at that time, we were on the dole. Back then it was called the dole. And just struggling, really struggling to survive. And we had absolutely nothing, no, you know, just lived on shoestring budgets. And to have this community as Pacific Sisters to look after one another, to feed one another, was the gift of what Pacific Sisters meant. And to not only that, to share everyone's ideas and to really tautoko everyone's ideas, and especially with me being Takatāpui and also trying to discover myself as a trans woman and being going through that transition, and my sisters surrounding me with so much love and so much support, was just like the icing on the cake. And they really, really protected me, all the sisters. And this is why Pacific Sisters, not only that we're this amazing group, but just we're family, we're true whānau, we're true sisterhood. So to me, we've done all these amazing things, but people don't get to see the true love of what Pacific Sisters is as a ropu.
It's so beautiful to hear you guys speak about it. There's just so much love in the way you talk about it. And yeah, it's really special. And I can imagine those relationships in that community is, as you say, really special as well. I do want to talk, of course, about your show at Tim Melville, Ngā Tae Whatu, Woven Dreams. At the heart of this exhibition is the idea of this practice of an idea of weaving. And I'd love to kind of start our kōrero about the show, more specifically, I guess, starting with that title and these intertwining themes. What is the practice of or symbol of weaving mean to each of you, both personally and more specifically in your art practices?
For me, it's that connectedness. It's about merging our DNA, our whakapapa together, merging our stories together. With Ani and I, it was all about we've known each other for so long. It was about our connection to sisterhood, to the Pacific Sisters. So it was all that merging. It was like collecting stories. United we stand, divided we expand. So when I say that, it's like as a group, when we're together, we're so strong, but we merge in our bondness. So when we are separated, we're collecting new tools, we're collecting new information, we're collecting new practices. And again, that's weaving into our art practice and into our stories where we can come together and share. So weaving to me is about connectiveness, sharing, and manaakitanga, whakawhanaungatanga, everything, yeah. So when you're weaving, you're embracing, you're holding, you're binding, you're making things connected and strength. Like I remember Ani was saying that as an artist, when you're a single artist, it's so you don't get to do things as well as a collective. And, you know, in any tangata moana philosophy, collectiveness, unification is so important, as communities are so important, you know, families are so important.
Yeah, I feel the same as Nephi, and that whole idea of everybody bringing their own individual kind of skill sets and knowledge and tools to the same basket. I think that's where Nephi and I really kind of made an exhibition that holds together really well. So some of the work, it's actually kind of led by Nephi, because Tim Melville, her gallerist, saw my work last year up at Stark White, which is my usual gallerist, and asked if it would be a good idea if Nephi and I had a show together. So that's how the show kind of came to sort of be in the first place. But he could see connections there already, but we were sort of on either side of the bridge in Newton. And he was like, I really want to see your work in my gallery. And I'm like, with Nephi, I'm like, oh, I'd love that too. How cool would that be, you know, to kind of share that opportunity of showing. I think Pacific Sisters, we get to kind of like go everywhere, eh, Fly, and just sort of share the love. So that was really cool to be able to do that. Actually weave our works together in the same space. And I just loved responding to Nephi's paintings. So if you go in, you'll see her paintings came first, and I responded to them with works that really sort of directly kind of like lock into her vibe. But they're definitely different, but they're definitely vibing on the same thing. And yeah, I just love that kind of sort of, it's kind of like a tension and a friction, and you know, we kind of pull things together, and they hold and they stack, and they're like magnets. And this, I think, yeah. when Nephi's in the room, she's just such a huge magnet. So yeah, it's so cool.
We're really excited when we put the color palettes together when you were weaving. Remember, we were so excited. We were like, oh my gosh, this is working! I can see the vision now. The vision's working.
I went down with Fiona to visit Nephi a few weeks before the exhibition to really kind of lock in, and I took a huge bag of wools, lots of colours that I thought would work, and sure enough, it was kind of like, whoa, matching, oh my God, so good. So we just did all these colour matches in her kitchen, and sort of were there for a couple of days and made a few works there, and then a few works in the car on the way down and the way up, and then had taken heaps of photos. And yeah, it was so much fun to make this work, make the show.
When Fiona and Ani did come over, mum's been having like quite major health issues, and my mum's 84, so she's just had these really quite serious admissions into the hospital. So I wasn't, even Tim and I, we weren't quite sure whether the show was going to continue. So there's been so much Māori that's been into this collection, like the Wairua. When I was painting and while Mum was at home, just the emotions that went into some of these, especially with the stars, because these stars represent a healing sacred geometry. So and they're about healing. So I needed to paint something that just healed. And I remember sitting in the garage just bawling my eyes out, because it's like, how am I going to fix my mummy, you know? And I said, I don't want my mum to go. So there was all these emotions and Māori going into this artwork. And when Fiona and Ani came, and it just sort of put another level, another kick in the door. So, and it just brought another level of Wairua into the works. And so, but it wasn't sadness, it was complete joy. So there was all these emotions that was going into the process.
Yeah, no, it's so wonderful to hear you guys talk about, I guess, the genesis of the exhibition and responding to each other and what that looked like, and particularly in a time that feels so uncertain for you, Nephi, and to be able to create something really meaningful and special and, yeah, joyous, because I think particularly with like those colours that you're bringing into that that space, you do walk in and you just feel joy from the works themselves. Yeah, it's really beautiful. I do want to talk, I guess, a little bit more generally on your practices. You both employ these quite rich traditions within your work, creating this dialogue between them and, I guess, the present. Are you each able to speak to this incorporation and how you kind of see the role of your tūpuna within your art making as well?
I work a lot with having conversations. Before I start my walk into the studio, I go to the lounge of the living room, and every Māori house that you walk into always have the death wall with all the photos of everybody that's passed, with, you know, all the nannies and all your tūpunas. So I activate the space. I activate my day by doing my karakias and doing my mihis and pepeha, and just, you know, and that just helps me to settle into myself before I start into the studio space. And that activates conversations with the studio, with the paint, and with the canvases. And those conversations will always be with my dad, with my Nana Charlotte. Those are the two that are always behind me and having conversations with them. So that's pretty much what my process, the beginning of my process, is always start with canvases. And as I'm painting, I do a lot of appropriation. So that appropriation is about back in the when I was at high school, back in the 70s and the 80s, that anything to do with Māori Pacific art didn't even exist in our world in the school curriculum. We were always presented, especially in the arts departments, it was all about European artists. The only time when I saw anything that was remotely Māori is when I went to Tangi's and entered the wharenui, and go to inside the wharekai, you just see, you know, you see all our carvings and pose, and, you know, that's the only time I was really introduced to the world of the old Māori art, toi mairangi. So schools was like predominantly European, and my artwork reflects that. And it reflects about appropriating artists like Gauguin and giving him permission to come into my space and allowing him, and asking permission also. So there's always a conversation about the, you know, there's a lot of people that cancel him. You can't, I can understand why, but the thing is that you can't cancel that he's not a great artist, because he's an incredible artist. So we have to remember that. And for me to my appropriation, because why I appropriate him, because when I was in school, I saw a book of Gauguin, who was like, oh, who's this woman artist? And it was like paintings of people, of our people, but not realizing back then it was all, you know, made up and fantasized. And so this is my way of reclaiming those stories that he's, you know, fantasized about through his lens. So it's like, it's my way of changing the narrative by adding my kōwhaiwhai patterns, especially the kōwhaiwhai pattern that I use, which is a pattern that's kahungunu, so which is the mangopare, the hammerhead shark. So I use that. So it's really changing the narratives of these colonialist artists, if you could say that. And I use stories of the history of my family, my mum's experiences, my dad's experiences, what happened to our people, what happened to my experiences, takatakuri. I talk about things about the moving away from the urban drift, where our parents back in the day had to go and find, and a lot of families had to go and find work. So I my storyline's all about, yeah, about whānau loss experiences, connection, whakapapa.
So cool to hear you talk about your work, Fly. So in this exhibition, I've kind of come back into the painting realm for me, which is using crocheted circular discs and stretching them over like steel rings to make flat painting, circular paintings, which, you know, like on first glance look quite poppy, you know, linking back to Jasper Johns and Julian Dashbow even. So there's a really nice kind of minimal aesthetic that you get from a distance, and then you get closer and you see that they're actually crocheted. I made the first series of crochet paintings back in 97 at the Rita Angus cottage down in Wellington. in Thorndon. I did that residency for 9 months, and I made a series of works called Cottage Industry, which were inspired by some placemats that she had in her cottage and the kind of idea that I really actually wanted to do some painting while I was down there, but ended up doing crochet painting. So yeah, merging that world with sort of fine art world. But they're really fun to make, and I think they I've sort of done various iterations of crochet painting works, and so I wanted to kind of use a slightly smaller hoop to kind of reflect and make really intuitive works that went with Nephi's paintings that she'd made. They were sort of like quite, you know, sort of fast turnaround and, you know, easy to kind of like produce, which is sort of, you know, in that kind of cottage industry vibe. I don't often make them, haven't done, I sort of do like a set of them or sort of sets of them like every 10 years or so. So it's sort of a cyclic thing for me like that as well. But then more recently I've been doing these lucky dip works, which are a set of 40 random kind of combinations. So there's like, and they're quite small, but they can get quite big. But they're, again, in the style of a bigger work called Rainbow Country, which a lot of people would have seen in Te Papa. So, you know, there's sort of like this cyclic process response and kind of, you know, beautiful pop aesthetic, which is sort of like really fun to make for me, who's like, in my real life, I'm quite a collector and a maximalist and kind of all over the place and all my threads are messy. So to have something that's sort of like sharp and looking kind of quite, you know, slick on a wall, I really love to kind of play with that because, you know, balancing it all out. It's, you know, especially next to Nephi's work as well, which is sort of so full of colour, like the combinations, the layers, the shapes and the mangopare and the colour combinations that are just like tripping your eyes out big time, you know, to have those kind of smaller circles, like those pinpoints of that moment kind of frozen on the wall is kind of a really nice balance to her work. But yeah, I don't know what more can I say except I really love making these works. Yeah, to actually respond to Nephi's work was really kind of the crux of this particular exhibition. I haven't really done that with anybody else, so I named all my works after Tupaya. So just because I really, you know, they're really connected to her paintings. So you can, you know, reading into her paintings, you can kind of then see what sort of sifted through in terms of the content within my own painting. But a lot of it is really kind of like a personal response to her.
That was Arnie O'Neill and Nephi Tupaia speaking to me about their show Ngā Tai Whatu, Woven Dreams, currently on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 20th of December.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
We've now got some Sharon Van Eden for you. For those who listen to the show know that I play her music all the time, and I did in fact get to meet her the other day, which was really beautiful. So enjoy the song.
I'm the runaway.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, A View for Each Eye by artist Mitchell McGrath is on at Window Gallery until the 7th of January.
As also mentioned on the show, Ngā Tai Whatu, Woven Dreams, an exhibition by Nephi Tupaia and Arnie O'Neill, is on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 20th of December.
Peter Robinson's show, Drawings, is on at Coastal Signs until the 5th of February.
A Moment to Hold, as well as Heidi Brickle's Wild Dividends, are both on at the Arts House Trust at Par Homestead until the 1st of March.
Echo, an exhibition by Tarika Saboal, Erica Holm, and Naruma Riley, is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 20th of December.
Tutahi Light, an exhibition of artist-made lamps curated by Heidi Brickle and Jack Hadley, is on at Grace Aotearoa until the 17th of January. Note, 25% of all sales from the show will be donated to the Auckland Action Against Poverty.
Revised and retitled by Benjamin Ord is on at Artur Contemporary until the 24th of January.
And Body Language, a group show exhibiting Di French, John Miller and Rokura Ture, is on at Season Gallery until the 20th of December. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us, Mitchell McGrath,
Arnie O'Neill and Nephi Tupaia. Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātoa, te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Sophia.
And I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95bfm. Keep it on the B.
Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.